Hi, I'm Andrew Connell, and in this module, we're going to cover REST and JSON Primer and debugging API calls. So specifically, what are we going to cover? We're going to start with just talking a little bit about the Partner Center options, the REST API, and the Managed API. We're going to talk a little bit about JSON in terms of an overview of what JSON is and what it looks like, do some REST core concepts, calling the Partner Center REST endpoints, and debugging REST requests. Now, I know that many people already know a lot about REST. I know a lot of people know a lot about JSON, but it is a new topic for some people, and there are a lot of important concepts here. So we want to have at least one module in this course that did cover this. So it's not a lot of Partner Center specific stuff in it. It's mostly just a primer around JSON and REST. So let's first talk about some of the developer options we have in the Partner Center SDK. We have two options. We have the REST API, which is a Microsoft-hosted endpoint, and it requires, it's an authenticated endpoint, meaning that you have to be authenticated in order to make requests to it. The way you're gonna authenticate with it is to first authenticate with Azure AD, then use the token you get from Azure AD to obtain a token from Partner Center, and then you'll include that token from Partner Center in every single REST request, either HTTP gets, puts, posts, deletes, patches, anything you make using the REST request, the REST API, for Partner Center. It accepts and it returns JSON formatted data, and the endpoint for the REST API is api.partnercenter.microsoft.com. Microsoft also offers a managed API, which is really just a managed SDK wrapper written in .NET for .NET development that is going to call and abstract away a lot of the plumbing that you have to do with the REST API in order to get data back and submit data. It also simplifies the authentication process. Developers can use either one that they want. They both have the full coverage of the features and full feature parity between the two. It's not that one can do one, the other one can't, because the managed API is really just an abstracted layer away from REST. So the managed API calls the REST API. If you ever want to see what the actual call looks like that you're making in a managed call, you can just open up Fiddler, which is an HTTP debugging proxy tool that is available for free online. You can fire him up and then run the managed code, and you'll see the response come right back. So when would you want to use the REST API versus when would you want to use the managed API? Well, the REST API is going to be great for projects that are not built on top of .NET. So a JavaScript-based solution or Node or PHP, Java, you name it. Those are good options for it. Maybe you have an application that's not going to be hosted on top of the Microsoft stack. It might be hosted on something like Linux, which we don't have a .NET SDK for today. The development environment, maybe you're using something other than Visual Studio. Maybe you're using something like Eclipse for like Java-based development, or maybe you're building some sort of an iOS app. Regardless, that you know, this is going to be a great option when you don't have a, when you can't knock it down or lock down your development environment to, say, Visual Studio on Windows and using .NET. Any of those other solutions are going to be great. REST is going to give you a great option for. Maybe it's just your personal preference. If you're a .NET developer and you choose to use the REST API, nothing's stopping you from it. The managed API, when is that going to be useful for you? Well, if you're doing a .NET project that's written in, say, C# or VB.NET, and Visual Studio is going to be your developer environment, this is really going to be a good option for you because it's got strongly typed objects. It is an abstraction away from the from all the authentication stuff that you're going to have to do and a lot of the plumbing and processing of the responses that come back from the REST API. The managed API is going to call the REST API for you on your behalf. So you're getting the same functionality. It's just a different developer experience. So let's do a little overview on what JSON is. JSON stands for the JavaScript Object Notation, and you can think of it as a similar format to XML in the sense that we have name value pairs and collections of entities and stuff like that. But it differs quite a bit from XML. First of all, it's much more concise, meaning that you have a much smaller payload, so there's less data that you actually send across the wire. Some people find it to be a little bit easier to read than XML as well. It's the common format used to exchange data for RESTful-based services is to use JSON. And we're starting to see it actually be used in a lot of other things as well, like in project formats for specific enterprise applications. Now, the way it works is that we have objects that are going to be grouped together with a little curly bracket. So some people call them the mustache brackets. We'll call them the curly brackets. And an object is going to be grouped with those different curly brackets that you see there. The properties are name value pairs. Now, the names are supposed to be double quoted, or supposed to be quoted using double quotes, and the values are also supposed to be quoted using double quotes, except in the case of numeric or Boolean types. Those should come back just as just the raw string of numbers or the raw Boolean true or false. Name values are then going to also be separated with a colon character so that you should be able to see the difference between the name and the value. Collections will be grouped together using the square bracket for like an array. And so if I had multiple objects, I'd use the square brackets. And then inside of those square brackets, I'd have an object, which is denoted by the opening and closing mustache or curly brackets, and then a comma, and I'd have another entity with the curly brackets, comma, another entity, etc., and so on. So here's an example of what JSON looks like. So you see here, I have an ID name. For the very first part, I have an ID as my key or my name, and null is the value. So null, there's obviously nothing specified there, so it's just going to come back as blank. Company profile, that is the name of a property, and that property is actually of an object. So you see that the company profile is actually referencing an object because I have the open and close curly brackets, and then two properties, one is domain, and one is name, a company name, and then you see the values there as well. Notice that the values are also separated based on a comma. A little bit farther down, you can see we have our emails. And so our emails, we have the, are set up in square brackets, and then you also have the address is there with address property with a value of some email at bar.net and another one address of some other email at bar.net. All right, so let's look at some different techniques in working with JSON, specifically in a .NET project. So one option that we have is to use something called a dynamic type. So a dynamic object, what this is it's going to bypass static type checking. You can think of it almost as like functioning like an object. This is going to be useful to working with JSON objects because there's no special work that we need to do in terms of typecasting these different things that come back. It does require that the developer does have an intimate knowledge, though, of the object schema that's coming back in the response and working with it in code. The compile time errors will not be thrown because schema mismatches are going to be exposed as runtime exceptions because you're effectively deferring the type checking. And so you need to be careful with this. Make sure you have good adequate test coverage if you're using dynamic types. So here's what one of these would look like here. You can see here that I'm creating a request and I'm going to get the response back. So what we don't see in this code here is I've already issued the request and now I'm just saying get the response and put the response in this response object. Then I'm going to use a stream reader to read in the entire stream and then stuff the results of that stream into a variable called the response content as JSON. And it's really coming back as a string right there. Now I'm dynamically going to convert the response to a strongly typed dynamic object. And I'm going to do that using the JSON convert.deserializeObject. And the type I'm passing into that generic is a dynamic object. And then passing in all the JSON. When that comes back, offer response has got all the properties that I would normally see on that JSON response that came back. So I could say something like offer response.items in a for each statement to go through and get all the results from it. That code actually comes from one of the demos that we did in the module on Crest API and Partner Center. I believe it was module 3. Now, another option that you have is to convert your JSON response to XML. JSON can be challenging to work with in .NET. The reason for that is because you have a little bit of extra work that you're going to have to do. One technique is to run the JSON responses through some sort of a processing function to convert them over to XML, and you'd get back an X document object back. That's going to allow you to do things like link to XML to easily go through and traverse the XML document to get stuff back. And it all works pretty just fine because all of that stuff is very, all of that is set up to be to work with collections. Just link to XML is set up to work with collections. So it makes it very simple. So here's what this would look like. You have a root elements are going to go to the root object and say for elements, you're going to look for something called an entity that A is looking for a namespace. And it's going to give you back an X element. And then that X element, I can say, let's look at all the descendants and find everything with the name of properties. And then I'm going to walk through each one of those properties. So I can say something like element.descendants, get the ID, get the title, get the status, get the property or priority. For each one of those, I'm having to say, get the first thing that comes back and then get the value. And that's giving me the actual ID value or the title or the status or the priority. So you see, there's different ways I can go through and work with this data that came back, converting it over to XML. Now, there is another option that you can use, and this is a fairly popular one. It's called JSON.NET, and we can use it to convert JSON to strongly typed objects. Now, the .NET framework does have a JSON serializer in it, but the JSON.NET is an open source project that is kind of seen as the standard for JSON serialization, deserialization in .NET. It's significantly faster and more performant than the one we get in the .NET framework. You can find some more information about it at newtonsoft.com/json. So what it's going to do is it's going to convert a JSON string to a strongly typed object, and it can also do the reverse conversion by taking a strongly typed object and creating a JSON string out of it. It does require a little bit of extra work up front to define your object. This is a one-time process, and there is a free Visual Studio add-on in Web Essentials that's going to help you build your class. So if you take a look at vswebessentials.com, you'll find some more information about it. I actually have a blog post on this if you want to go take a look at it. You just go to the link there at the bottom of the slide. It talks about processing JSON responses server-side instead of using XML. Essentially, what you're going to do is you're going to create an object, a .NET object, that is going to mirror what you would get back as JSON. So in this case here, I have two objects that I've created at the top. One is a sptask JSON collection, and one is an sptask JSON single. If I did a query against a REST API, and I was going to get back one item, it would only give me back just that one item and not a collection with a total of one item. Instead, it may give me just that one object back. However, if I'm getting back multiple items, I'm going to get the same schema back, but instead of it just giving me one object, it gives me a collection of items separated with those square brackets. You see here that each one of these both have a property called data. Now, in that property, the first one's going to return back for the collection, has a data collection response, and the second one has an sptask JSON object coming back. So you can see at the very bottom of the slide, I have a class called sptask JSON with three string values, title, priority, and status. But the class right above it, data collection response, is actually going to return a collection, an array of sptask JSON objects as the property results. So what I wanted to do is I wanted to create two different ways of using this, one at the top for the collection, and one in the middle there for the single item. What I want you to notice, though, is, like, let's take a look at that middle class, say data collection response. When I'm working with the objects coming back in my .NET project, I don't want to work with the lowercase results collection that comes back. I want to work with something called results with a capital R, because that really matches the naming of the API naming that we get with .NET objects. So I used a capital R for my results. But notice the JSON response that comes back is actually going to be a lowercase r for results. And so what I did is I used an attribute here for JSON property and specified the property name to be lowercase results. And so what you're going to see from this is that now I don't have to worry about having my names not match up with the names that come back from the JSON response. For example, you can see that in the two objects at the top there. They both come back as the property name in JSON is just the letter D, but I've renamed that to the word data so that I can actually have a better, more typed thing, so I know what the D really is. I know it's really just data. So it makes it easier to work with. Now that I've defined that class, and by the way, let me jump back to this class here that you see. The thing that Web Essentials helps me do is that if I go get a sample JSON response, and if I select the JSON response and go into Visual Studio, in the edit menu, there's a copy or paste is special. And one of the special options is paste JSON as class. And what it does is it will paste a class that looks just like this, except it matches all the property names that we see in the JSON that comes back. So you see here what I've done is I've just used those annotations to let me rename the actual objects that I can work with in .NET to match the JSON property that's coming back. Okay, so once I've created that, now I have to use it. So the way I do that is I'm going to call json.convert, say deserialize the object, and pass in the type of the object that it's going to deserialize it to. Now, you need to be careful and make sure that these things match up, meaning that the JSON in the response string that I see here on that first line has to match the same schema as my sptask JSON collection. If it doesn't, I'm going to get a little bit of a exception. I'm going to get a big exception, actually. So here, I'm then able to say sptest.json response.data.results, enumerate through all of those, and now I can work with my objects. It's not too bad. All right, let's talk about some core concepts here as far as it's concerned with REST. Now, each entity in a REST endpoint is going to have a well-defined endpoint. That's both true for both entities or single items and collections. The platform REST APIs or REST services are generally platform and technology and infrastructure agnostic, meaning that every platform can, for the most part these days, can issue an HTTP request. There's no limitations of how you end up wanting to use it. It's just REST is a style of writing an API. You have three different things as far as HTTP is concerned, because HTTP is used to talk to a REST endpoint. You have verbs, request headers, and status codes. Verbs are going to be defined before the endpoint in the request. So they're going to actually be defined as part of the request and telling it, like, what do I want to actually do with this? Right? And we'll look at some of those options in a minute. The request headers are going to describe the request. So they may have things like authentication headers. It may have things like what kind of data can the client that's making the request, what can he expect? Like a browser can say, I can expect HTML, I can expect JSON, images, PNG, JPEG, GIFs. It may say it can accept everything. It also allows you to specify the type of data being submitted. So if I'm doing a post, I could say that this is going to be JSON data that I'm sending across the wire. And then last is status codes. And this is just a code that comes back with every response that tells the client what the results were of what actually happened. Right? Was it good? Was it bad? Did an error happen? What kind of an error was it? So let's look at the verbs. The verbs are used to tell the endpoint what action you want to perform. So it's going to describe the HTTP request. So you have like a get is going to request data. A post usually creates a new entity in a collection. A put is going to potentially update an existing entity. A patch is going to update only part of an existing entity. And delete is going to delete the entity. And I just included the specification there for HTTP verbs as well, just for completeness sake. Here's some common request headers. We have accept, authorization, content type, and if match. Accept is going to describe the type of data that I'm requesting. So in my case, for Partner Center, I'm going to say application/JSON. The authorization is going to be the token. It's going to include the token in the form of a bearer token that I'm used to authenticate the user and the request being made. The content type is going to describe the data being submitted. So it's going to say, like I said before, if I'm submitting JSON data back or if I'm using a form encoded data, those kinds of things. If match is used, say, when I'm making an update, I can say only update the item on the server if it has the same, what's called the same version, or in the RESTful terms, we call it an e-tag. So every item that comes back from a REST request has an e-tag, which is just some sort of unique string. Different products do it different ways. When I send the patch back, I can say only update it if the e-tag on the server matches this e-tag value. And the way that that's going to come in handy is that, let's say I got an entity and I'm doing some work on it, but in the meantime, while I'm doing some work, someone else updated that entity. They got a request, they made some changes to it and saved it. When I go back to save my change, I'm updating version number one, but effectively I would be updating version number two. So I want to tell the server, don't update it if it's not version one anymore. If it's version two, then tell me, you've seen products that do this. They say you need to refresh it to get the latest version and then make your changes. The last thing we're going to talk about on this point about core concepts are status codes. So this is these are some of the more popular status codes that you would see. So a 200, whenever you're doing a get request, you always want that. You want to see an okay come back. So that means a success. It was good. If you create something, then you generally want to get a 201 back. That's the server saying it was created, and usually you're going to get back the entity as a JSON response that was created. 204 says no content. So if I issue a delete, it just says it's okay, it happened. 200s are successful codes. It says there's nothing here to give you because I deleted the items, so I have nothing left to return. The 400s are errors that happened. So things like a bad request for 400 saying it's just something that's not valid. 401 and 403 say either it's forbidden or it's unauthorized. So you either are you're not allowed to do what you're trying to do, or you don't have permissions to do what you're trying to do. A 412 is a precondition failed. So that's the code that's used when you have an E tag that doesn't match what's on the server that you're trying to update. And then finally, error code of 500, that's bad. That means the server had an internal fault, and it either did, it may return a response message, but regardless of what it is, it doesn't fall into any of the other categories. It's just a flat-out error. Now, as far as REST development and debugging utilities, there's a couple different options that, you should be familiar with. They are, you don't need to use all of these, but they're really handy. So, but you have to take a look at a bunch of them, find the one that best suits you. So you have Fiddler Tool. What Fiddler Tool is, it's for Windows, and it is a HTTP debugging proxy that enables deep inspection of all HTTP requests and corresponding responses. It's going to enable the creation of HTTP requests within the tool, and it's going to help you really learn, it's really going to help you really see what things, what requests and responses are being made. We're going to use it quite a bit in this class. I would strongly recommend, though, that you get comfortable with how to use filters, because what one thing you'll find with Fiddler is that it tracks every HTTP request and response. And with a tool like Visual Studio, when you go into debugging mode, there's a ton of telemetry data that's sent, that's made between both Visual Studio and the process. You may end up having things that phone home as well, like Windows Update, or if you're using services like OneDrive or OneDrive for Business and Skype, with Outlook open, you'll see it gets really chatty in the window. So you'll want to set up some filters to say, I'm only interested in these domains or not interested in these domains. I find filtering, whitelist filtering is much more effective. Another tool is Postman. Postman is a cross-platform tool. It's really served up as a, the Chrome browser has an extension model, and Postman is served in using that Chrome model, that Chrome extension model. It's very similar to Fiddler in the sense that you can create requests and submit them and see the response comes back. It's not a debugging proxy, though, so it doesn't trap all the requests that are outbound and show you the responses. It does save all the queries that you make so that you can go through and play them back if you want to see it that way. And you can check that out at getpostman.com. If you experience errors in the SDK, this is just a word of guidance that I have. If you experience errors in the Partner Center SDK, and really for that matter, any SDK, if the error that's given back to you from the SDK is a little cryptic, or maybe it doesn't make sense, or you're a little confused by something, I usually like to see the raw error that comes back from the RESTful endpoint that the SDK is talking to, because sometimes the developers of an SDK may try to abstract away some of the details from you, but those details may actually help you troubleshoot the problem. So I'd get familiar and comfortable with that. All right. So let's talk a little bit here about calling the Partner Center REST API endpoint. When you want to call the Partner Center REST API endpoint, they are specific endpoints that are going to be covered in other modules. I want to talk a little bit more about just the general pieces to it. So like selecting, paging, filtering requests, creating entities, those sorts of things. The first, let's look at the authentication, which we've covered a few times already. Again, you're going to have to authenticate using a Azure AD to get a token for either app only or app plus user. You're going to use that token to ask the Partner Center for another token for Partner Center. You're going to do that by passing off your AAD token to prove you're authenticated. And then you're going to issue the request to the Partner Center REST API with the token you got back from Partner Center. All right. So let's take a second and let's kind of look at what this authentication flow looks like. So what I'm going to do is let me come over here, and in the demos here, I have this SASV file, which what this is an exported trace of a previous Fiddler request that I made, or previous request that I made and then I saved with Fiddler. So here, this first bit up here, the red part is going to show one style of authentication. If I scroll all the way over here, you can see in the comments that it says this is an AAD authentication, app plus user authentication, and then getting the Partner Center token. The second one is app only. Okay, so let me scroll back over here and let's look at this one. So this one here, we're going to the Azure AD token endpoint. If we look here at this raw request, so let me open this up a little bit. Over here at the headers, you can see a bunch of stuff has been passed in here. So we have a bunch of different things that are passed in. Some of this stuff is being generated by the Azure Active Directory Authentication Library, ADAL. So here we can look at my forms, or the web forms. And so here's what was actually submitted. So here I can see that my RESTful endpoint is the api.partnercenter.microsoft.com. That's the resource I'm requesting. The app in Azure AD that I've created to do the authentication. The style of authentication we're using. Password indicates I'm using the OAuth flow of resource owner password. And then I have the credentials for username and password. And then finally, I'm telling it that I also want to use the OpenID style of to get a token back for OpenID. I can look at a response from this. I can just get my mouse to go like this. I can look at the raw response, which shows me there's a 200 that came back, and I can see all these other header values that came back. Now, I'm going to switch it over to JSON, because if you scroll down here at the bottom, you can see it's giving me this long, big string right here that's a JSON string. If I switch to JSON, it'll parse out that string and show me these different items, where it's really easy to see how these different things are set up. If it was XML, I could have clicked on XML and seen an XML rendering here. But you see here, I'm getting some errors down here at the very bottom when I'm doing the parsing. That's because it's not XML. One thing I do want to point out to you is that when you do authentication, and if you have any kind of an error, like an exception pops up, you may be in a scenario where you need to talk to support to get some extra information about the request you're making. And usually I find if you can provide a fiddler trace, it's really going to help them identify what's going on. Now, the one thing you want to be careful about, though, if I come over here and I select this guy, notice that it says username and password. These were actually the username and passwords I used when I authenticated to trigger these requests. Now, what I did is I want to make sure that when I save all these sessions, so if I had all these sessions, I saved them all, and then I said file, save all sessions, it's going to export it out as an SAZ file. What I would recommend you do is if you come over here, I can select a session. I can say I want to, unlock for editing right here. And what that'll do is I can then come over here and you can see I can change the values here that show up inside that request. So effectively, I can rewrite history. But what's nice about it is I can remove my username and password so that they can only see the token. And since those are only good for about an hour, it's going to be just fine. I don't have to worry about it. Here's where I'm taking that same request. I'm using that token that came back. You see here in the headers here. I'm using that token that I got back from Azure AD. And the web forms, I'm able to see that I'm saying for this client ID, for this app ID, I want to authenticate a Partner Center. That was what a request looks like for a user plus app scenario. In an app only scenario, if I select this, you can see it's changed to where now I'm using the grant type of client credentials instead of password. I'm using an app ID and the secret for my app. And again, I'm not showing you the secret here in this case. Once I get that token, I can do the exact same thing to generate the token over here. Now, the part that I mentioned about filters, here's what I would definitely recommend you do. I'm going through and I have a setup here for all these different filters. And let's just copy these out and I'll show you, make this a little bit bigger, and I can break the line up here a little bit for you so we can see what this shows. Okay, so here, what I'm doing here is I'm showing, and I can get rid of two or three of these I know we don't need. So what this is a semicolon delimited list, and it says, I'm only interested in HTTP requests that have these domains. So either the Partner Center domain right here, the login domain for the authority for Azure AD. So the line 2 is the older style, line 1 is the newer style. And then I'm also any other call to Windows Azure or Azure.com. I also want to see those. What I did with the filters is I actually told Fiddler that I wanted to only see traffic from those requests. I see show only the following hosts. I also am hiding out certain URLs, and these are things coming from Visual Studio in the debugging sense. Once I created this filter, I just said actions, save the filter set, and then I saved the filter set somewhere so that I could open it up and load it up again. What that does is that now anything that does not match that request will not show up in this timeline over here on the left. And like I said, this gets pretty chatty, so you want to make sure you try and slim it down. Okay, let's go back to our slides. Now, let's talk about paging requests with a Partner Center REST API. It's always good practice to group requests in pages. You want to include two parameters on the query string, the size and the offset. The size is the number of items you want to include in a page of data. This number has to be below 200. If you try and explicitly state it above 200, then you'll get an exception back saying it's got to be below 200. If you don't put a size, then 200 is assumed. Offset is the number of items to skip. So let's say if I was on page 5 and we had page sizes of 5, what I would say is that, the page sizes are 25. So that's a typo in the slide. But you can see there in the sub-bullet there where it says size equals 25, offset is 100. That says I want to be on page 5. How did I do that? I looked at the current page index, which is 5. I subtracted 1 from it, so get 4. I multiplied the page size. Now I have 4 times 25 is 100. That says skip the first 100 items, get the next 25 items. And that's going to allow me then to sit there and page through my data. Okay? Now, what about searching and filtering with the Partner Center REST API? I can also limit the result set in my request by providing filter criteria that I pass off to the server. Why should I do the filtering in my application? Let the server do it. The filter criteria is passed as a JSON string on the query string. So you see here I'm saying I want to get a list of customers. I only want the first 25. And I'm going to do a filter. The field I'm filtering on is the display name field. The value I'm going to filter on is A. And the operation that I want to filter is starts with. So this says, give me all the customers, give me the first 25 customers actually, that whose display name starts with the letter A. The filtering syntax, it's broken down. We have a filter, the field, that's the name to filter on. Only specific fields can be filtered. We'll look more into that and how we can figure out which ones are our filter options. The value is the thing that we're going to filter. And then the operator is one of the different options coming from a specific enumeration. When I come over here and I look, you'll see that, if I look here on this slide, you can see where the enumeration is filter field operation, which will give us a list of all the different things that are there. So it starts with equals, non-equals, greater than or less than, greater than, et cetera. There's a little more than 10 options that we have. Now, what about creating entities in the Partner Center REST API? The way you're going to do that is by issuing an HTTP post. You're going to point to the endpoint where the entity should be created. You're going to create a few extra headers. Content type, which says the kind of data that we're submitting, should be JSON in the case of Partner Center. And the content length, and that's the string length of the data being submitted. What that does is that tells the server, here's how many characters you need to read, how many bytes you need to read off the request in the body of the request. So that's how much stuff is coming. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to create an entity as a JSON object, and I'm going to pass that in the body of the request. There are also a few other Partner Center specific API HTTP request headers that are required. One is the xlocal. So the xlocal defaults to ENUS in the SDK, but you need to set that. This is going to be the locale that you're working in, the one that you require. That's going to define how the data comes back. The contract version, the MS contract version, should be equal to V1. And then the MS correlation ID is a GUID. Now what this is that this is an ID that is specific to the request. This can be very useful in network traces or logs. This should be unique in every single HTTP request you make. You may have seen this in certain errors that you get back in different products, specifically like in Office 365, SharePoint, or in Azure. If you see an error, it says, here's a correlation ID. And when you open up a service request or a service case with Microsoft, they may ask you for the correlation ID. And that allows them to go back to their servers and look up a specific error that you're talking about. The request ID is also a GUID. This should be unique for the request, but not for every single request that you make. This is used to ensure item potency. So what does that mean? If I try to create an item, and let's just say it times out, the correlation ID may change between me doing all the retries, try it again, try it again, try it again, but the request ID should stay the same. And what that's going to allow us to do is it's going to allow us to say, this thing that I'm trying to do, even though I'm trying to do it like 5 or 10 times because timeouts are happening, it really is one thing I'm trying to do. So the request ID should be the same for all 10 of those requests, where the correlation ID should be different for each one of those requests. So if each one failed, I can say, here's the 9 correlation IDs that came back as timeouts, so that Microsoft can then go back and look at those correlation IDs and track to see what the actual problem was. Okay, So let's look at some of these different things of creating entities with the REST API. So I'm going to switch back over to my demos here. And let's take a look at this trace. So actually, this just added stuff. So let's actually open it up again. Customer traits. All right. So here's a request to actually create a new customer. So I'm going to go to the inspectors, and we'll look at the headers here. We're creating a customer. So I'm doing an HTTP post to the v1/customers endpoint. So I'm going to, you can see the full request here is API Partner Center Microsoft.com. Other headers here, I'm passing across JSON data. The length of the data I'm passing across is 754 characters long, and I want to get back JSON data from the server. Here's my correlation ID. Here's my request ID. You can see here that the Partner Center is even sending back some additional data to the server when I make those requests. There's the X locale. Here is the authorization header. If I go look at the raw request here, you can also see that not only do I have all of these different headers defined, but I also have some JSON here. If I click on the JSON piece on this side, it shows me the actual JSON object that I'm submitting over to create a new entity for. If I come down here and look at the raw response, I can see that the item was created, so there's a 201 created, gives me a little bit more information about it. At the very bottom, I get JSON back. That JSON is a representation of the entity on the server. So this is effectively kind of like the same thing as saying, go create a customer and then go get that exact same customer back. So if I was doing an HTTP GET on the REST endpoint, I'd get this back. Notice that E tag that I was talking about as well. Okay, so that's how we can go about creating a customer. And I have a couple other things here where you can actually look at in the samples when you look at the course, where you can see what the raw request looks like. So here's a bit more exploded version of it to see the whole thing. All right, so let's jump back to our slides and let's talk a little bit now about debugging REST requests. Now, I'd strongly recommend that you use Fiddler to debug your REST requests. Now, again, this only works on Windows, and there's other solutions that are out there for people who are on OS X or on Linux or other platforms. But for Windows, Fiddler is your best choice. It's the ideal tool for when you're experiencing errors with the managed API or the REST API. It's going to help you identify if you have a code problem or if you're using the API incorrectly. Many times raw errors, as I said before, can be more helpful than the errors that come back in the exceptions. When you're sharing errors in forums, though, or with Microsoft or anyone else, Fiddler traces are going to be the most helpful. But like I said earlier, be careful. Don't export the sessions and include your password or any sensitive data. I showed you how to modify the Fiddler trace, so definitely take advantage of that. So let me show you what an example is of this. Let me jump back over to my demos. If I come back over here to the fourth option here, and let's get rid of Fiddlers. Let's clear all the sessions out so we don't get any crowding here. Here's a request that I'm making here to authenticate. So in this case here, I'm making a request. This raw request here is, let's see what he's actually returning back. He's not giving me any data back here. In this case here, it's fine. But here's the one where the problem is. So I see a 400. And so I'm making an HTTP post to go authenticate. You see, I'm passing in a password and there's my ID. So we did everything we've done before. But this came back as a 400. Now I may just get an error that says the authorization failed. But what actually happened? So in here, if I scroll down, what you'll see here is there's my 400 bad request. I see I got a bunch of other headers coming back, but what I'm really interested in is the JSON response. There's an error that says invalid grant. I've been doing this long enough that I know what that means, but I may even get an error description. And some of these error codes may be listed in documentation. Here's this error code. What does this mean? I scroll over, it says no permission to access user information is configured for that GUID application, or it is expired or revoked. And then it's giving me a trace ID. So what does that tell me? Well, that's telling me that I never gave this application that I'm requesting access to talk to this endpoint, right? I never gave it access to do that. I just went through, and if you remember from previous modules, I probably just went in and created a native application, and then I didn't onboard it with Partner Center, or I didn't go through and grant it and give it the Partner Center permissions. I just said, go authenticate, I need something for this endpoint, and I know that it's saying that there's no access to user information or maybe it's from not having the right permission on Azure AD. And in fact, actually, this is probably an Azure AD error because I see the AAD STS is the Azure AD STS, which is the thing that does the authentication. So no permission to user to access user information is configured. That's actually an Azure AD error. And that's one where I forgot to check the permission that says I can access data for the signed in user. Okay? All right. So that wraps up our module on REST and JSON summary. So what did we talk about in this module? Talked a little bit about the Partner Center development options that we have, both being the REST API and the Managed API. I did a JSON overview. We did the REST core concepts, talking about verbs and status codes and headers. We talked about how to call the Partner Center REST API endpoints. And then finally, we talked about debugging the REST requests. So that's all we had to do in this module about doing about working with REST requests.